Welcome to Driven Minds. I'm Gigi, and this is a Type 7 podcast. So, this is the first episode of the fourth season of the show. If you're joining for the first time, bienvenido. Thank you for being here. And please make sure to check out the three seasons that came before this. We've had some incredible guests, and while you're scrolling, please do not forget to subscribe. Our season four premiere is Kat Graham. Kat is an actress best known for playing Bonnie Bennett on the hit show The Vampire Diaries. She's also a dancer and a singer with two albums and two EPs under her belt. So here it is, my conversation with Kat Graham, which we recorded in person in New York City. We are cut from the same cloth because I read that you are an Eastern European Jew.
Yeah, that's it.
So I guess it's less of a cloth, more of a schmata.
Like you can't tell. That's my mom said this. It was really funny. She's like, you know, she doesn't really look like a Jew, but she sure acts like one. She's like, what does that mean?
I was just going to ask, by the way,
what does that mean? I don't know. So I grew up in Jewish day school and also summer camps.
Okay, all right, you went up to me there. I was not sent to Jewish summer camp. You know what, in fact, actually, my school wasn't even a Jewish school. It was that everyone was Jewish there. I think the entire grade was bat mitzvahed. You know,
like amazing. Yeah. No, we were, we had a cantor and we were very busy doing Jewish things.
Oh my God, tell me everything.
My father was pretty abusive, so we had to separate from him around like age five. My mom had worked on, and I had even worked on trying to build that relationship over the years. I had decided to focus on my acting because it was really difficult to do school and be on set. So I did homeschool.
But you started acting when you were around six, right?
I started acting when I was around six. Mm-hmm. Around like age 13, 14, I started to really feel out of control. My grandmother had moved. She had sold the house. We were having a lot of financial problems.
So you were living in LA at this time?
I was living in LA in like a really, like we were in a really just shitty one bedroom apartment. And I went from having a pretty solid childhood, you know, abuse aside, that I felt really good. I was surrounded by a lot of people that made me feel accepted and loved and taught me spirituality and tolerance and diversity. And I felt like I had a really good school, and then all of a sudden we were broke. All of a sudden I was dealing with a lot of rejection in Hollywood, realizing that there's not that many like black Jewish girls running around here, and I didn't have a lot of friends. I was making beats. I was like this.
How are you doing this?
I had used money from like backup dancing and like extra jobs, and then I would buy my own equipment and I would turn our already tiny one bedroom apartment in Hollywood into like a little mini recording studio, complete with stockings on wire hangers and recording in closets and just like the most like hood version of it.
Creative
but
version.
Creative. And my mom tolerated it. So I was just weird, broke, and I really started to feel I'm doing the best that I can creatively, but I don't want this to be my life.
Right.
And so I started reading a lot of self-help books. Deepak was obviously one of them. I would read a lot of Napoleon Hill. I would read anything that I could to try and figure out a way to get my mom and I out of this poverty. It was, sometimes we couldn't even afford food. And the lack of control made me realize that, well, the only thing that I feel like actually could shift this would be God. And I actually haven't ever talked about this, but I made a contract with God. And I said, what do I need to do to prove and show that once I get to where I believe I'm meant to be, what can I do to be of service? And in meditation, we came up with like an agreement of like how I could be of service. And I think I'm in alignment with that. I'm definitely keeping my end of the deal, for sure.
What is your end of the deal?
I mean, most of it is my work with refugees.
Yes.
Because I do come from refugees, from my grandmother who was Holocaust survivor to my grandfather who was in the Liberian Civil War. And he was, you know, I became a refugee from that. Mm-hmm. So I have that kind of history, but it's also just being somebody of service that I would be honest about what I went through and not hide it under, even though, you know, we both come from fashion and it's very easy to just only show the really beautiful, shiny aspects of it.
Totally.
And it wasn't until I started to really be open with my own struggles, with my own insecurities, or the fact that I have been different, or being honest about the abuse I experienced as a child and things like that, that people were like, oh, mm-hmm. and they started to see me. And then at that point, that's when I started to, I think, bloom.
Are you open to talking about the abuse?
I do. I talk about it. Yeah. I mean, it's not necessary. I don't wear really anything on my sleeve. I'm a Virgo. So like you get enough. Like, you guys get enough. I had done a bit more of it when I was doing more wellness stuff. I had a company with two of my friends called Modern Nirvana. We did that for a few years. One of the founders decided that he wanted to go in a different direction, so we stopped doing it. But, you know, we did really cool videos where we went to like a rage room and we would bring something that meant a lot to us. So I brought like the last photos I ever had of my father and we just destroyed them. And it was like really healing process and learning how to use anger as a way to heal. Because a lot of times people don't necessarily, they're scared of their own anger or their shadow self.
Completely. And also taught to suppress it, right? Women cannot get angry.
No, it's just like men have that stigma about crying. Women totally. Have that about anger, especially Black women. Like, we almost have this stigma on us where you can't get angry. You have to be polite and easygoing and easy to work with, especially as an actress. I'm a Black female actress. Like, I'm constantly right. being told, behave.
Right. Or stay in your place.
Stay in your place. And I had a lot of anger right. that stemmed from my dad's situation, the poverty situation, a lot of abandonment stuff. And I've worked on it. It's something that I've always had to, I mean, my rage, if you've watched my show, you've seen it. I put it in my art, for sure.
That's clear.
But yeah, no, I do a lot of work on myself. Because I'm like a Hulk! I'm just kidding.
I love the idea of a rage room. And I actually did something similar. Do you know this program, the Hoffman process?
Yeah.
So I don't know if you've done it.
I haven't done it yet.
But they do an entire day where you are given a wiffle ball bat and a piece of paper, and you write down basically your dark side, and you get down all of the negative beliefs that have ate at you your entire life. Mm-hmm. So I am stupid. I am not lovable. I am, what were a couple of mine? My brain is broken, because that's what I was told my whole life with my OCD, and I had ADD. So I was XXX disorder, right? Attention deficit disorder, mm-hmm. obsessive compulsive disorder. So I was just one walking, living, breathing disorder. So I wrote down all these things, and they give you a wiffle ball bat and you destroy the paper. And you get so in the moment and you are filled with so much rage. And that is the exact point, to feel every ounce of rage you have in your body. And then this entire huge piece of paper ends up in like 100 different pieces. And it's incredible. And then you just like burn it all.
I love that.
This rage room thing, if you need part two, highly recommend this program.
Yes, it's great. I mean, I learned so much about how to get through things by actually allowing myself to feel them. Mm-hmm. I think as women, we are taught to suppress more than I think people realize.
There was this period in your life before The Vampire Diaries, which happened around 18, 19, right? When you got cast for The Vampire Diaries. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And from my understanding, you were acting in different shows, you know, Malcolm in the Middle, The OC.
Yeah, tiny things.
Yeah, like
guest
you had,
stars.
You know, a part here and there.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of no's, which anyone gets when they're starting out, especially when you're a teenager.
People get it now.
Yeah, of course.
There's so many projects. People that have much more under their belt than me get told no.
Yeah,
so
of course.
The way of the world.
How did you get through that period morale-wise? Because, you know, I also read that you shot 6 pilots before getting cast in Vampire Diaries. You know, when you're at that pilot number 6 and you're like, hey, it's not
you
getting...
stop caring.
And that is powerful.
That's the power.
Yeah.
Like, you genuinely let go and you surrender. I remember the week that I booked it, my first love, Sky. Sky had dumped me. He was blowing up from this group, LMFAO, and he was crushing it. And I was broke and jealous of just the girls he was around and the career that he was having. And he was working with some really great people, and I just wasn't. And I was back to living in this tiny one-bedroom apartment with my mom. I couldn't get a job. My car had gotten repossessed because I couldn't make the payment. Like, everything, it was like the worst week. It was right. A week of my life. And I was like, my mom's like, you got to get a job. I'm like, nobody will hire me. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be a backup dancer for the rest of my life. I can't keep doing extra work. It's not enough to pay any bills. I don't make enough money to even support myself. And I had this audition for this show, and I was kind of over it. I was still going to continue my dreams, but I was also like now looking at, you know, I had this degree in recording engineering.
Okay, so you went to full college?
I went to Musicians Institute to get a degree in engineering because nobody would help me make my music. So I was like, well, I guess I'll be making it myself.
Yeah.
You know, I was writing scripts and I was just trying to figure out a way to be my own vehicle.
But still following this creative path, which
still
I salute
following the
you.
Creative path, but also heartbroken and be like, well, I've reached rock bottom.
Right.
I mean, I had 86 cents in my checking account, but I think my credit card was like negative $5,000 or something by the time I booked the show. So it's definitely in the negative.
Yeah.
And I was just in the negative in my love life, in my finances, like my home life, my everything was in the negative. And I was like, well, God, this is it. Like, I'm surrendering.
Right.
I've done everything I could do. I've trained my mind. I'm not just asking for a handout. I've done everything I could do to show you that I want this. And I'm not giving up, but I'm going to allow the universe to now move me.
Mm-hmm.
And even when I booked the show, I didn't give a fuck. Like, I didn't care because I'm like, it's just a pilot. I've shot 5 already. This is
right.
Just, I'm just excited to get this check. And then even when they were like, well, the show got picked up and you're going to shoot in Georgia and it's happening. I'm like, yeah, all right. Like, you, when you have so much poverty and abuse and rejection through the majority of your life at that point, other than like the light of Jewish day school, you're suspicious.
Right, of everything.
Of everything. Of everything working out. I mean,
right.
Even to this day, if I get some good news, I'm like, are you sure?
It's a too good to be true syndrome, which I have as well. I totally
hear you. I have a
you.
Too good to be true syndrome, and I'm working through that. And the trust, I don't trust people. I don't trust scenarios. So I slept on an inflatable mattress for the first 6 months of the show. I didn't get any furniture.
No.
I was like, I don't trust these motherfuckers. I don't trust this situation. I don't trust these creatives. I don't trust this show. I don't trust none of you motherfuckers.
That is wild.
I'm going to save these little coins. I remember Nina Dobrev walked in one to my little like room. It was a studio room for like $500 a month. And she was like, where's your bed? I was like, I'm just ready to deflate this mattress and go home at any moment. And that's just how I've just always felt, where I just don't trust things. And unfortunately, when you have those situations, they can leak into your personal life.
When did you start believing in that show, right? So you're like down in Georgia, you're shooting a show that would end up becoming one of the most successful dramas on the CW.
I never did.
You never did.
I ended up, I eventually got into a better apartment, I think in like year 2. Then I saved enough money and bought a townhouse. I was bi-coastal because I thought at any moment I was going to go back to Los Angeles.
Oh, wow.
I was bi-coastal until 2017. The only people that I've ever truly trusted outside of a couple cast members were the fans. That is where I put all of my trust.
Mm-hmm.
That is where I put a lot of my love and my energy. I do not trust the industry.
Mm-hmm.
I don't trust executives.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't. I don't have a trust towards them. And there's just certain people where I might work with them, but if I've seen enough red flags, I usually only need to see at this point of my life, now 33, just one red flag, and I'm like, okay.
Did you ever get out of your own way for the Vampire Diaries, or were you always... Okay.
Oh, no.
So what was that process like?
Oh, gosh. Well, I didn't really understand what an artist meant. Mm-hmm. I knew I liked to sing and dance, but from almost like an amateur, like little girl attitude of, I like just having fun and playing pretend.
Did you ever take acting classes, or were you just a natural?
No. I'm naturally not good at anything. Like, to be very clear.
I don't believe that.
No, I'm not. I'm really naturally like kind of bad at everything. And I had to work really hard. I think episode 6 or 7, I was aware of a woman by the name of Ivana Chubbuck, who is like the Stanislavski of modern day acting. And she's, I think, the best acting coach alive. And at that point, I'd always kind of played pretend. I was like doing my Disney stuff. I had done my little CSIs and like Malcolm in the Middles and all of like, and even dancing, everything had felt very pretend or theatrical. But I, you know, I was booking, mm-hmm. so it was good enough, but it was playing pretend. And then I read her book, and at the time she was also coaching Ian, but Ian Somerhalder and I weren't really friends until, you know, years later. But I became obsessed with this woman that said, stop pretending, start using the things in your life mm-hmm. for your art. And I'm like, no. What do you mean? Like abuse and neglect and the things that I've been running from my entire life and using acting and dance and music to escape. Mm-hmm. Those things, you want me to face it?
Right.
And then put it in a character on screen for millions of people to see me fall apart? That's terrifying. Continue.
Continue.
And then year one, something really peculiar happened. My grandmother had gotten very ill, and my grandmother had always represented the little bit of safety that my mom and I had, because once she had moved, we were poor. She always represented stability. And she passed. And here's the weird timing of it. There's an exercise in Ivana Chubbuck's book called like the coffin exercise, where you actually see yourself putting dirt over somebody's grave. And in the Jewish religion, you physically have to do that. My grandmother had an Orthodox burial, even though her eyebrows were tattooed, which is a whole other thing.
That's why I never got a tattoo, girl. That is why I never
you
got
can
a
actually
tattoo.
Technically, I think in the Torah you can cut it out.
No, you,
or whatever,
you totally can.
But that's beside the point. But her funeral was the day before I had to go to set the next day, and my grandmother died in the show. So within 24 hours I had buried my real grandmother, and I had been reading Ivana's book, and I was like, I don't know what's going to happen to me in my career. I'm sleeping on an inflatable mattress. I'm on a show, but I feel very alone. If anything's going to shift, and if I'm going to actually try what this woman is talking about, this is the moment. Mm-hmm. And I did it. And it was the first time like the crew had given me like a standing ovation. It was also the time where I was like, God, I'd rather be naked than do this. And I'm like, is this what she's talking about? Like using the darkest points? Mm-hmm. Is this my like dark night of the soul? And I was like, oh, okay. And I ended up crashing one of her parties. She had like something.
Ivana's party.
And I snuck in with Cottrell because he knew some guy at the door, because he was like, we were just these kind of like scrappy LA kids. And I said, you know, I have to work with you. I'm working on the show, and I'm desperate to work with you. And now I work with her on everything, and she's been my coach now for 12 years.
Wow.
There's not one thing I've done where she hasn't worked with me on it.
So that was a huge turning point for you then.
That was my turning point.
And did you get off this blow-up mattress? Did you get a place, you know, under the conviction that this was going to be a long-term show, or?
I leaned into my art, and any money that I had, mm-hmm. I was actually I'm not sure if I should even say this, but I was the lowest paid of the cast for 6 years. I didn't find that out until later. It didn't matter. I was so broke, I would have been happy to sign anything.
Right.
But I did find out that I was the lowest. But I used my money for Ivana. Mm. So as long as I had money to cover my coaching and to do my work and to cover my art, that's all that I cared about. Mm. It wasn't until, you know, years later, probably like 4 or 5 years later, that I actually bought property, because all of my money
went back to yourself and your craft.
Always went back into my craft. I kept investing in myself, and I still do that.
Yeah.
As long as I have a roof over my head and I can take care of my mom and my family and my animals, like everything else goes right back into my art.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah. And how'd that feel when you found out that you were the lowest paid member of the cast?
It didn't matter, because at that point I felt I was one of the strongest actors. Mm. So I didn't care.
Yeah.
Because I was like, at that point, when it comes to acting and mm-hmm. it comes to my craft, I just wanted to be a really great artist. That's it.
I read that there was a scene in The Vampire Diaries where your character had to cry and you actually mustered authentic tears because Prince died and mm-hmm. you guys were amigos. Mm-hmm. And I need to know how that companionship formed, because that is iconic.
Yeah. Yeah. He's still guides me a lot from the other side. I don't even know how he found out about me. I was working on the Roxbury Drive album, and I think my publicist, Polis, had called me, and he was like, "So, Prince would like to talk to you." And I was like, "All right, like, what is this?" And I thought maybe that my publicist, who's my friend, was messing with me, and I kind of brushed it off. And then I remember he called me. We had a couple phone calls about art and music, and we shared a lot of the same sentiments around the music industry, and we were very alike.
So it was like immediate connection.
Yeah, like I've known him many lifetimes.
Right, right.
And we just got along, really great friends. And I remember he called me one day on my birthday and told me to get on a, he was like, "Hey, what are you doing right now?" I'm like, "I'm getting on a flight to Mexico to go hang out with my friend for my birthday." He's like, "Why don't you come to Minneapolis?" I'm like, "Well, I'm at the gate." He's like, "Change your flight." I was like, okay. I had to call my friend and say, "I'm not coming to Mexico." And she's like, "Why?" I'm like, "Well, I have to go to Minneapolis." And I, you know, she had a great time in Mexico, but she was like by herself.
Oh my God.
And I felt terrible, but I consider him still one of my best friends.
So what happened that weekend? You go to Minneapolis.
Well, he doesn't celebrate. I know I'm supposed to say in the past, but it's so hard because I just.
We can use present
I feel
tense.
Like he's so here. He doesn't celebrate birthdays because he's a Jehovah's Witness.
Okay.
So he didn't give me a birthday cake, but we did spend my birthday that year in the studio, in the recording studio in Minneapolis in Paisley Park. And we listened to a bunch of records, and it was great. That was also one of the first friendships that I had where speaking about a divine connection and also being an artist of incredible merit, that you could blend the two, that you could be somebody that spoke from a place of depth and understanding, and to not sugarcoat yourself for the media. Because how you and I speak is how he and I would speak, and we would go deep, and then I would watch his interviews, and he'd be the same way. Mm. Like he's not different. Privately, he was much more silly privately than mm-hmm. I think in his interviews. Very silly, hilarious person. But in interviews, he would be very deep about God and the connection and
right.
divine understanding. Like he's very much like that. Yeah. And I just started surrounding myself with, I started looking at what I didn't have in my life, but from a place of, well, what do I want to have? I want to have really creative, incredible people. So throughout, I think around like 2013, up until now, I really surround myself with incredibly prolific men. Everything that I thought that my father could have been, every male energy that I've wanted in my life, I now have, but they're different forms, they're different people. Mm-hmm. And same with my mom, you know, I'm still, will always be there and take care of her. through her health and her ups and her downs, and I'll always be a support. But I also understand that I need certain women in my life mm-hmm. that offer me certain things as a mom that I don't have. And I think sometimes we look at what we don't have and reduce ourselves to, well, this is our blood, so this is all we have. But I actually have an incredible tribe and community of mothers and fathers and aunts and uncles and friends and brothers and sisters in my life now, because I don't have a lot of family. So I've had to kind of curate this really incredible group of people around me.
So you stopped talking to your dad when you were like five, right?
No. It was up until about like 16, 17. It was like kind of like one of the last times that he had attacked me, I was like, okay, I can't physically be around you anymore. I think that was like the last time.
And he would verbally attack you or?
No, both.
Physically attack you.
And I think at that point, I just couldn't do it anymore. It became more about like for him than for me. Because I grew up watching shows like, oh my gosh, I loved like Nickelodeon or like Seventh Heaven.
Oh my God, of course, like the aught shows, like the late 90s, early aught shows.
Family Matters.
Oh my God, all of it.
And I would see these like Full House. And this idea of family was always something that just seemed so foreign to me. So the idea that I would have to ever at any point completely disconnect from a parent was just like, no.
Right.
Like
you're willing to sacrifice yourself to keep the
physically,
vision.
Mentally, spiritually, everything to have that, to say I have my dad and I have my mom. And the reality is like, my mom has always had, she's always been very sick. She's always had like a lot of heart problems. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of that has been connected to my dad or my brother right. and never kind of dealing with things. So they've manifested. She's always had like open heart surgeries, ulcers. Like she's never been like a healthy person, in and out of hospitals. And then my dad hasn't been around. So I've spent so much of my life not feeling with having any stability, any family, any, you know, and then I'm in this career that's just like this.
And dependent on people external to yourself, right? Like
right.
you don't choose if you get casted, they do.
Right, everything has felt out of control. So yeah, that's why I think when people are struggling with worth or external circumstances that are dictating their happiness, it's maybe not the nicest thing to say, but you're never gonna fucking get it.
Mm-hmm.
You're never gonna get the validation. Maybe some people have gotten it and they have these perfect, amazing families and these perfect, amazing careers and these perfect, amazing relationships. That's so foreign to me. I don't know what that looks like. That's not where I operate from. I operate from a place of loss.
And so eventually you did decide to sever ties with your dad.
I had to, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and not from a place of like, I hate you.
Right.
Fuck you. Although that happened
yeah.
and you go through that, but from a place of, I love you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry I can't be there to take care of you in your old age, but for my own boundaries.
Right.
And so that I can be of service
mm-hmm.
to the world, because that is an agreement that I made with God.
Right.
If I am going to be of service, I can't be abused.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, you don't understand boundaries, mm-hmm. a physical space, emotional or spiritual space, and you're not willing to look at that. And if you were willing to look at it, just like anyone who's suffered addiction, if you're willing to look at it, I will always be there. But if it's, you can't help people that don't want to help themselves.
Yeah, completely.
So yeah, you know, sending love and light, but other people's journeys are not your journey.
Totally true.
God, it's so hard.
I know.
God, that is so hard.
So I want to quickly go back to Vampire Diaries.
Mm.
Did you experience any sort of anxiety on the show or anything?
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, I was grateful to have a job and I was grateful to do what I love, but I had felt so different.
In what way?
I was always a spiritual person. My whole, not just my genetic makeup, my upbringing, my culture, my fashion sense, everything about me was different from my cast and the crew. I didn't have, other than like, I had a couple friends that I knew from LA, and I was part of a drag house. So other than like my drag community, I was at the time, I was doing a bunch of like club gigs in LA before I booked Vampire Diaries. I was doing all my music stuff, and gay clubs were the one place where
So you're DJing?
No, I was doing music. So okay. I was like doing records and running around with Perez Hilton, and we're just, you know, doing all of the, you know, all the drag bars. Like mm-hmm. that's where I would perform. That's how I started. And the only place that I actually felt comfortable was the gay clubs and drag shows. But those were the only times I felt like I was with like my own people, people that were just like fiercely creative and unapologetically themselves and were also different. And I didn't feel so alone. My anxiety came from feeling so different and feeling like I was treated different. Even though I grew up in Jewish school, and even though I was the only black girl in Jewish school, I didn't feel that different because there were people from the Middle East in the school. Like, we were going to the Museum of Tolerance. Like, everything was about love and acceptance. Mm-hmm.
But you're united because you're all Jews, right? So it's like, yeah, you have one commonality.
One commonality, and I didn't feel that different. I felt, you know, what we do on Shabbat, we're all doing the same thing.
Right.
We're all, you know, practicing the same language. But yeah, I felt very, very different. I was this like, you know, Hebrew speaking black Jewish former backup dancer hanging out at the gay clubs. Like, I was just completely alone. And even though there are friendships, there's nothing like being with your own people. And I don't even mean like even culturally, just even spiritually. There was nobody that was that into, you know, meditation or God. A couple people were atheists. Like, it just, I felt completely out of my element for most of the show. That's why I leaned so heavily into my fans, because my fans also were, in a weird way, outcasts in their own ways. And I spent a lot of time talking to them on the weekends, and I still do. Like, every other weekend, we do these, like, free Zooms. My social media manager, who also is, like, one of my exec directors, he's overall fan captain, and he picks people from all over the world, only like 6 to 8 people, and we spend about 1 hour, 2 hours every other weekend.
That's so wonderful.
9 a.m. on Saturdays, and we just talk.
That is
and
wonderful.
They're all from all over the world. They're all ages, and we just talk, and I just check in on them, and it was just for free. We just do it for them to also be reminded that we're all connected. I'm not somebody that ever necessarily struggled with like deep anxiety, but I've always struggled with feeling so different. Mm-hmm. It hasn't really until after the show ended that I feel like I've been doing projects and working with people and really being celebrated for being so different, which I think also is a lot to do in part with a shift in the industry. You can't just kind of sidebar minorities anymore. Like, there's...
Thank God.
But at the time, I was so thoroughly sidebarred in so many moments to the point where there was so many reactions online to it that the feeling that I was different was even more heightened by the public's perception and understanding of it as well.
Can you give an example of feeling different on the show, whether it was cast members, crew members, executives?
Everything from my clothes, my hair, my relationships, the storylines, the love interests I would get or not get. A lot of things I feel were based around the fact that I was different. Mm-hmm. And had I been a Caucasian female, I do think that the writing would have been different. I also think that, again, love, forgiveness, compassion, understanding.
Of course.
I genuinely, fully, in my whole entire being, believe that everyone on that show did their best based on their level of awareness and understanding. And for that, I am supremely grateful that I was a part of that journey for them. And hopefully, post the show. They have a deeper understanding of what it means to write and produce and direct a minority.
Yeah.
I hope that. And I have nothing but gratitude
right.
and love for all of the creators and the writers and everything. I harbor no
right.
judgment. None.
And when the show ended, you were, you know, you spent 19 to 27 on the show. When I think back on this time in my life, I mean, I had like 5 personality reinventions. Mm-hmm. I, you know, had different lovers. I changed jobs. I moved to fucking Germany. I moved back again. Like so much happened. There was so much change. What was it like ending the show when you'd had this one constant in your life? Like, was there any sort of identity questioning that you had, or were you happy to be done?
No, I felt that I spent 8 years playing somebody else and somebody else's choices. And through those 20s, at that point, I'd been obviously working with Ivana multiple times a week,
right?
Dealing with my own stuff, becoming super empowered, becoming more spiritual. By the time the show ended, I was fully myself. Even though I hadn't necessarily been playing myself on a show, I'd been playing a character that was all about sacrificing her own happiness for other people. But the reality is, the paradox of that is that I had become the complete opposite of that.
Mm.
That I'm not gonna sacrifice anymore for anyone else.
Right.
I'm gonna live in my truth. I'm gonna put myself first.
Right.
So all of those things were existing simultaneously. When the show ended, I didn't cry. I cried when Nina Dobrev left.
Why?
I wanted us to always have this, the full journey together.
You guys were close?
Mm-hmm. Still are. And I wanted her to be a part of it till the end, and I didn't. And she was one of my closest friends. And it felt like that loss of her on the show got me.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else, by the time the show ended, I was like, I was good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
next
sent
chapter.
People some Foster Grant sunglasses, got a couple food trucks, bye y'all, it's been cool. At that point, I was getting better offers. I was ready
right.
to make more money. I had been playing the same role for yeah. forever. I wasn't interested in returning.
Right.
And then I ended up doing like 18 film and TV things since then.
Yeah.
And I'm happy. Like but I have a lot of love and gratitude because I spent so much of my 20s dealing with the fact that I was powerless.
Right.
And that show forced me to look at where it actually comes from.
Mm.
And without that show, I would not be who I am now. I'm so grateful.
You are the spokesperson for Loestrin.
Yeah, I was.
You were.
Yes.
And from my understanding, it's a low estrogen birth control.
Right.
And I saw this clip of you talking about how your journey to finding a good birth control was difficult. It was complicated.
Yeah, it's complicated.
But I loved that you did that because we so often just hear about what works and not about the journey that it takes to find what works.
Yeah.
So I'm so curious, what motivated you in
yeah.
your own birth control journey
birth control?
To become a spokesperson for this brand?
Well, first of all, I'm not promoting a pharmaceutical anything that I'm not on.
Yeah,
I have
a lot
of young people, young girls that follow me. Let me get on this first before
right.
I start fucking with y'all.
Yeah,
and I did. I got on it and I loved it. And sometimes my period would just completely disappear. Mm-hmm. At the time, and I'm going into like a season 2 of this podcast that I had started called Women United. Women United is a women's health podcast all about destigmatizing our bodies and our conceptions of mental health, life, everything.
Mm-hmm. It's our war cry over here.
I'm just all about destigmatizing these conversations. And just it came at the perfect time to be like, all right, since I'm talking about periods and menstruation and like all this stuff anyways,
yeah.
and hormones and misconceptions about women, our emotions, our this and our that and our bodies, this seems like this could be a really good fit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was. But my thing is that no matter what birth control you're thinking about, make sure that you have your OBGYN do a blood test on you.
Why?
So for me, and this is a lot around results of my diet and also aggressively working on set, my thyroid had started acting up.
Same. Do you have hyper or hypo? I guess you have hyperthyroidism.
I don't remember which. I think it was hypo. My thyroid, my cells around it were getting a little funny. My mom has had her thyroid completely removed.
Oh, wow.
So I'm already kind of potentially vulnerable
right.
to that. Your thyroid, it's probably one of the most important things that you have as a woman to mm-hmm. monitor. Make sure that your levels make sense for whatever
yeah.
you're putting on your body, in your body. That goes for food, clothing, environment,
skincare,
hair products. Make sure you have a thorough understanding
yeah.
of what your blood is doing and what your body is doing and what works for you. Like, a lot of people want a specific kind of lifestyle, but it's not conducive to what their body is communicating to them.
It's so funny because I feel like you are probably similarly, I'm totally projecting, but similarly sensitive mm-hmm. as I am, and just mm-hmm. aware and instinctual.
Very sensitive.
Yeah. I
don't think I'm an empath, even though I've been told I'm an empath. I don't feel other people's stuff like that. But I am very sensitive yeah. to it.
Sam, and I tried birth control, a low estrogen birth control. It was like during college, I was dating this awful guy and he's like, oh, like, let's have unprotected sex. So, you know, we don't have to,
right.
you know, worry about anything. And I
right.
was like, all right, fine. I did it totally for him, not for me. Mistake
That's
number one.
Red flag.
And what ended up happening was even the lowest estrogen birth control on the market at the time in like mm-hmm. 2008 or something mm-hmm. was so miserable for my body. My boobs were, I'm like a A, B. They went to like large C.
Yeah, I had gained a lot of weight.
Oh my God.
Once I got off of birth control, I lost a lot of my weight. But Lola was great for me.
But I love how serious you take it, because I feel like even my OBGYN was yeah. like, oh, just take it. It's not a big deal. You know, everyone does it. And then I tried like three different birth controls. Nothing worked. Then they were mm-hmm. like, okay, try the IUD. I started researching about the IUD. It personally yeah. scared the shit out of me.
I loved the NuvaRing. Like,
you did.
This is not a paid sponsor. I'm officially out of my low deal, so I can say what I want. And I had always done the NuvaRing, and I always yeah. felt that was like the absolute best. Now you guys know, this is a very revealing podcast. Now you guys know what's been in my vagina.
That's what we do here.
Who cares? Whatever. Why are we being so precious about all of this stuff?
Agreed. It's 2023.
Stop being so precious about it. Like, get information that you
Completely.
Need for your health, for your mental health, for your physical health, for your sanity. Like, stop being so scared about
yeah, asking questions.
You've got
demanding
to ask
answers.
Questions and demanding answers. And you know what? If you're not happy with what your OBGYN is saying, get a different OBGYN.
Completely. And that, by the way, I think that's a huge thing that you just said, because we so often take, if you are a doctor, if you have a PhD, we accept their words as fact. And that
right.
is not always the case.
And there are so many, there's so many great people out there. I mean, other than like, I mean, Dr. Mindy, even, she's just really incredible and taught me a lot about like fasting and health. And we interviewed this woman, Dr. Carrie, who specializes in hormone health and destigmatizing things. It's just like, there's so many great, incredibly brilliant women out there
yeah.
that can help guide you to your best self. And you gotta get through maybe the difficult journeys within your body, or the difficult prescriptions or birth controls or therapy or breakups or whatever yeah. to get to your best
well,
self.
Also paying attention to what you just said. Like, if a medicine doesn't work for you, like for me, when I was on birth control, I was like, me and
if
this
it doesn't
thing
work, stop.
Does not work. I'm like, I'd rather
yeah.
use the pull-out method or right. a condom. Seriously. Which, by the way, is a method. So I'm like, I'd rather do that. I felt like my body was being poisoned, and I totally realized
yeah.
that my friends swear by birth control. It helps. By the way, it's amazing.
And
for
it might
endo.
Work for them. And
totally.
It might work for them.
But
we are so
yeah.
The body is such a delicate thing.
And it's not one size fits all.
No, it's really not.
You know?
It's really not.
But I think it also you know, to your point, it's so important to be so open about this stuff. You know, what goes hand in hand for me with birth control is also just STI checks. And like when you're talking about unprotected sex,
yeah,
I find that to be also so important. And that's another thing that I feel like we don't take seriously as women. You know, I recently started seeing someone new and I asked him to get tested and he did happily obliged. Great. And when I told a good girlfriend of mine, who's a strong, independent woman who I often go to for
advice. Let me guess, she doesn't ask for it.
Not only that, she goes, I can't believe that you would ask your boyfriend because at this time we'd only been seeing each other for like a month. And I was like, I was like, no, that is a boundary for me. I will not have unprotected sex with someone who I don't have their test results.
Right.
Because this shit is serious and it's we don't take it seriously. And she was so floored that I even, you know, had the quote unquote balls to ask for this.
No.
And I was like, that is so incredible to me that we as women do not feel the right, or we feel disempowered by men and by the patriarchy, or call it whatever you want. Whatever it is, there is something in the fucking air that is making us feel reluctant and guilty for advocating for our bodies.
There has to be, like I said, there's so much empowerment in being in your truth. I've learned from having unhealthy parents. Love you guys, but if you don't have your health, you don't have anything.
100%.
It's literally the first stop. It's your foundation. If for whatever reason you put yourself in a vulnerable position, whether it's with a man, a woman, or even making yourself vulnerable to experiences that can potentially affect you in a negative way mentally, and you are making yourself vulnerable, and you don't put your health, your mental, your physical, and your spiritual health first, you cannot be surprised when all of a sudden your life just stops. Whether you can't get out of bed because of you're depressed, or you're sick, or you're in the hospital, you gotta set yourself up to win. You gotta set yourself up to win in a relationship, and you gotta set yourself up to win just in life.
And it all adds up. Like these small things you just said, like it's all corner cutting.
Oh,
like,
it all, you know what I mean? It all adds up.
One thing leads to another. I mean, not advocating for yourself, then you have low motivation, or, you know, for my
it's
mind,
a cycle.
For instance. And it's true. And like,
it's
sorry
a cycle.
To, completely. And like, not to like keep talking about STDs, but like times where I haven't advocated for myself and done something that I haven't wanted to, then it sticks in my mind.
Yeah.
And it's a hamster wheel of, oh my God, do I have something? Oh my God, I have to wait that 2 week period to get tested. So I'll test positive if I have it.
Like, I know.
You know what I mean? So you end up harming yourself. You should never sacrifice anything that has to do with self-care for someone else. Well, we have one question, final one. What drives you?
Oh, you know, the first thing that popped into my mind was my mom.
Why?
Because my Virgo brain is like, no, think of something else.
Right.
Like, don't talk about your mom.
The emotional and the rational.
Yeah, like my rational brain is like, no, talk about Josephine Baker.
Yeah, right.
Talk about—
Also iconic.
Like, talk about the women that inspire you in your career. Like, become a diplomat very quickly. And I'm like,
Yeah.
The reality is, how do I say this? So my mom never dealt with her heartbreak.
From your father?
And my brother's father, just like her heartbreak period. Like, I don't even know the depth of it because she doesn't share anything with me. But she reached her limit in her life that she set up for herself because she didn't like really look at herself and deal with the losses in her life. They manifested in different ways. And what drives me is to be the opposite, to be somebody that deals with every loss and every heartbreak and every disappointment and every rejection like warrior woman and say, bring it! That's what drives me, is to push through these brick walls of no's, of I don't want you's, of you're not good enough's, so that I can get to this really free, limitless place.
That, my friends, was Kat Graham. You can follow her on Instagram at Kat Graham, and you can follow me at Gillian Sigansky. As always, I want to hear what you think of this episode and every episode, or any episode. And please don't forget to subscribe and rate us so we know that you're out there alive and listening. Until next time.